Thank you, Tony. All right, next up we have from Gemalto. We'll get things going here. No, it's not that one. There we go.
On the desktop. It's this one.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Okay.
Hi. Good morning, everyone. My name is Will Tung. I'm with Gemalto. My colleague and I are going to talk about how much MI certification is really worth and how to keep standards relevant in a changing world. The first section talks about who values what and how we link value to assurance. So why do we have certifications? Certifications provide an independent assurance and third-party verification to vendor claims. They also provide a minimum security bar for competing products to meet, potentially removing some barriers to market. As a result of implementing this security bar, protects market from products who make bogus snake oil type claims for their security. Certifications give product vendors and sales something to point to so that repeated justification of security claims is no longer needed. Finally, certifications provide a shift in liability where the consumer can fall back on claiming that they're using a certified solution. This diagram shows the different players in the certifications landscape with each of the general reasons for certifications placed within. You can see from the diagram that different players have different motivations and definitions of value for obtaining certifications. So what does assurance mean? The dictionary definition of assurance is a positive declaration intended to give confidence. Assurance should not be confused with security, and a product that has obtained a high level of assurance doesn't necessarily mean that it's secure. Instead, a high level assurance should provide a level of confidence in a product. So what activities do we use to generate assurance? There are many types of activities and options that a test lab may choose to utilize to generate independent confidence that a product meets target requirements. Here are some examples of assurance activities, and we've found that there's three categories that they can fall into generally. The first is verification of functional requirements, where this is your typical compliance testing. There's also non-deterministic testing, also known as unbounded testing, which can include side channel analysis or vulnerability testing. This often has the highest variance in results in this category. The third, product lifecycle management or investigation and review. And depending on your specific assurance activity, one or more of these three categories of assurance is met. You can see that code review and design review can be used to cover some verification and functional requirements, but it can also be used potentially for non-deterministic testing. Going back to the reasons for certification, we can also apply these same reasons to the same Venn diagram with activity categories. You can see that there isn't a single class of activities that provides value, which is why we see a range of assurance activities. Now we can see that each of the reasons also fits into these categories of assurance testing, but you can note that not a single assurance testing category covers all the reasons for certifications. So what are typical problems that impact the value of certifications? As we've witnessed in participating in several certification schemes, there's a measurable overlap between different standards, and repeating the same independent testing across multiple certifications can be very costly and time-consuming. Compliance testers may not fully understand a product or a technology type to find real vulnerabilities or problems in products. The scopes of certifications can often be set too tight to be of any real-world use once it's been deployed to end users. Human error introduced by labs and mixed interpretations of requirements by vendors as well as certifying bodies can diminish the perceived consistent value of certifications. So there's this balance that needs to be maintained when it comes to resources spent for obtaining certifications. It's very difficult to make a quantitative assessment of the value of assurance. Some examples of value activities include, or some examples to the vendor that increase the value are increased profit in certifications from related sales, increased time savings from reducing the need to explain product security claims. However, this is offset by the cost of certifications, cost to obtain the certifications, and the cost to the test lab to perform the certification. To the end user, they can benefit from savings from a reduced need of internal testing, and they can also gain value from reduced security risks. Again, this is offset by a cost premium for purchasing certified equipment, and increased maintenance costs also diminish value. So, this next section is how are standards developed and what can go wrong? Standards are developed in three ways: open, closed, and hybrid developments. In an open development, anyone can join, contribute, and propose changes to the standard. There may be voting mechanisms in place to decide on changes, and oftentimes there are time windows in place for expiration of these standards. A closed standard is the opposite, where a government organization or an investing body in the industry can run the development. They may solicit some contributions from end users or the industry, but typically this is very limited. The decisions are made by the government organization or the body in charge. A hybrid development is a combination of both and can be seen as ideal, where a closed group looks to leverage open standards. And an example of this is the ISO 19790 standard in development and its application towards FIPS 140-3. So what's changing in the certifications landscape? The internet makes for a much more global, connected standards development community. Standards developers are now able to collaborate virtually with minimum overhead. The end user, as a result of technology, is increasingly more security aware and savvy. The internet also helps raise awareness of insecurities or vulnerabilities as soon as they crop up these days. And finally, the availability of existing certified components has become more prevalent, which results in reduced costs in achieving certifications. What can go wrong with certification standards? As mentioned in the previous slides, the scope of a certification can become too narrow, resulting in a mismatch between how a product is intended to be used versus how it has been certified. Certificates can become too expensive and too long of an investment. Standards can be very averse to change or very static, and a product can become stale by the time it hits the market, stale or obsolete. Certifications can become too complicated for labs to test, and labs aren't expected to be experts in all technology types, so this leads to inconsistencies in test results, and changing requirements and standards can further draw out and prolong the certification process. Now my colleague Graham will talk about good things happening today and how we can change our approach to assurance.
Hello. So taking over from Will, we've got a section where we're going to cover some of the good things that we're seeing happening within the certifications landscape, alongside some new ideas for other additional things or things we'd like to highlight that we think would help standards stay relevant and increase, maintain, or avoid losing their value going forward. So first off, looking at some of the established changes, there have been a lot of positive developments in the certification landscape recently. So we thought it was wrong to start with a load of fresh ideas without drawing awareness to some of the good things that we see and we encourage. We've decided to identify three areas that we'll discuss a little. The first one, development of new technical communities to help evolve standards and shape standards. It's not a new idea, but it's one that we see as revisited, but critically important to keeping standards relevant. So CMVP with their industry working group, CC with their international technical communities, and PCISSC with their task force and their working groups are all really relevant things in keeping those standards grounded. We see them as critically important to keeping the standards grounded and in keeping in mind the needs of the end user and the technologies they serve. The second item is the release of open standards, as we've already covered, as part of hybrid developments or as an alternative to closed standards. We see this as a positive step to increasing the reuse of our certifications or certification artifacts across multiple markets. One of the consequences of closed standards is that they typically only consider a narrow branch of technologies or a narrow market, and it makes it very difficult for other markets to reuse the certifications or deciding to set up their own ones. Open standards often, but not always, benefit from wider set of inputs in helping to maintain, which help to maintain a balance in the value in their direction. The final point we thought to highlight was the introduction of more requirements focused on the secure development lifecycle. This is something that either as a vendor makes very little impact on you, or it can turn your engineering world upside down. Essentially, introducing new requirements in the secure development lifecycle extends assurance to how you develop a product and not just the traditional of what it does. We feel that this is taking into consideration some of the feedback in recent events to help start to look more at the root cause of most of the security problems and look at the value that some of our assurance activities today bring to the table. As something we don't talk about much, we think as a final point, the introduction of requirements in secure development lifecycle does help justify the expense of SCLC in large organizations. As one of the trends we're seeing small security companies bought up by big corporations that want to adopt common processes across all developments. Sometimes in this situation, it's very hard to justify the extra expense of security and the things that you need to do to make products completely secure rather than just making sure that you meet the functional requirements. So moving on to some of the new ideas we thought we'd like to float. So the first one we've labeled as flexible testing, although it's had a number of different names in developing this presentation. But essentially at its root, it's talking about allowing multiple paths to assurance. So one of the things we discussed is inconsistencies in certifications, which can come from mismatches in assurance activities to either the product, the testing lab, or the tester. One of the things that we wanted to draw attention to is that not all paths to assurance and the ways that you build confidence in products are suitable for all products. So taking an example, what you can achieve with code review of a small product that, say, has 3,000 lines of code is completely different to what you can achieve with code review for a large product that might include components from multiple vendors in multiple languages and different styles with millions of lines of code. At the same time, labs, despite their love for testing, don't all have the same mix of skills. In a world where security specialism is difficult to get hold of, not all the labs, not all the testers have the same skill sets, which leads to variations in qualities as they're working through the certifications. So as an idea, we thought was worth considering. We'd like to see more flexibility when it built into the standards to allow labs to tailor the assurance activities they do to the product, to the testers they have available, and to the set of circumstances surrounding the certification. What we're not suggesting is that we change the security levels or the requirements that are there. So if you did FIPS 40-2, you still have 4 security levels and you still have the same function requirements, but what you would do differently is that there'd be more options available for the lab to test how the product worked. taking the example at the bottom. On the left-hand side, we've kind of identified our weakness, which some certification and assurance activities might choose to mitigate for end users. And then on the right-hand side, we've put down a number of different options. The exact options aren't so critical, and there's lots of different things you can do, but the main principle is that there's different ways that you can generate assurance, and different examples are suitable in different use cases. Quickly running through them, recognizing time. So option A, reviewing developer practices and compliance testing might be the most suitable option to generating assurance for a complex product that has a lot of code, or where simply the lab doesn't have testers that are familiar with the technology or the coding standards that were used by the organization. Option B, where you look at the design documents and you perform code review, might be the option you select where the product's a smaller product, it's less complicated, it's got good design documentation, and the test lab in question happens to have testers who have specialism in the language that's been used or the technologies that the product, technology family the product comes from. The third option, option C, might be the one that you choose where you look at development practices reviews, you look at the documentation and you perform some form of vulnerability testing. That might be something that you choose to validate a requirement, whereby the requirements spread across a large amount of code, or the product's just too complex to test in traditional methods from a compliance testing point of view. What we wanted to kind of identify was that there are multiple paths to assurance, and the idea would be that you can develop packages of assurance activities that are broadly equivalent, that give you some confidence that the product does what it says, without necessarily having to do the same thing every time. So moving on to our second idea. Five, why not introduce some entropy? It's a word that's come up a lot of times in a lot of presentations at this conference in recent years, and we wanted to apply it to certifications. Why do we need to test every requirement and all the same requirements with every certification? Our conjecture is you don't. So taking the example on the right-hand side and looking back to today's, most of us would like to forget, but how many exams do we sit at school and university that look to test 100% of course content and ask the student to answer 100% of the questions every time? I think the more common situation is that you don't, and we'd like to try to feed that back into certifications. Cutting down on testing requirements as a route to slimming down certifications is something we've already seen. So with NIAP and their revised approach to, and Common Criteria's revised approach to CPPs, we have gone down the route of cutting down the testing activities to make the certifications more manageable and address some of the issues with value that come from long certifications. There's a potential problem with this in that if you openly say we're only going to test these requirements, then you do have vendors that have less pure motives than others, and it does allow you to prepare your product essentially for the requirements that are the ones that you know are going to get tested. We can see that going full circle, and that as that results eventually in vulnerabilities in products that don't get spotted by these certifications, then there might be a temptation to go back to testing everything again. So going back to entropy, if we randomize what we were testing, and then this avoids ability to predict to choose what will be tested, and ideally for this to work, it wouldn't be possible to pick or predict which requirements were tested or reviewed by either the lab or the vendor. It has the benefit that allows you to maintain the depth of testing, but reduce the effort that you put into certification overall. So as a simple example, you might choose to do compliance testing of 80% of the requirements within FIPS, and of the 20% that you didn't do compliance testing, you might choose to do code review for. So it allows you to maintain depth of testing in a certain area, but it also allows you to build confidence in the product. One of the other good things with this would be that for products that go through multiple validations, it's not necessarily that you're throwing away checking certain areas, because the next time you go through a revalidation, you pick a different area of the product, and over time, you would increase the coverage of the testing that was there. But the whole root of it is that assurance is only our confidence that the product does what it does. It doesn't make it more secure, it's just an independent measure on whether the vendor said what they would do. So moving on. So, taking a wider view of all the certification schemes, some are better at this than not, but why don't certifications or labs in general ask for feedback? It's one of these simple things. When we started the presentation, we may have oversold it as data mining, but when we started to look at how you could mine data within the certification community, we just started with a simple, why don't people ask for feedback? It's not a new idea, and it's one that's been penned about for millennia. So one of the things we wanted to draw attention to was that feedback, in our opinion, shouldn't be confused with review. All the standards are very good at publishing new versions of standards and then pushing them out to the vendor community to allow them to comment on the standards, but at that point someone's already second-guessed what the best direction for the standard is and what the changes they're going to make are, and you're really only commenting on the changes. What we're suggesting is that before you invest the time in making changes, that you have some form of mechanism that allows you to gather feedback on how you should be developing the standard, such that you can choose the ways that are going to be most beneficial to the standard to develop it to go forward. Within the certification landscape, there's lots of places where you can get feedback. And for even kind of going back to the previous example, if you wanted to see whether sample testing was effective or not, you could go back to the labs, and if you had a feedback mechanism and said, how often do you actually find non-compliance by doing compliance testing with vendors that turn up time and time again? And I think the feedback would show that it's not something that generally throws up problems. Moving on to our next item. It's not necessarily a new idea, but it's just something that we want to draw attention to and we think is very important in managing standards and the various standards going forward. So certifications inherently involve conflicts of interest that can skew standards and hold them back from developing. Linking back to the first part of the presentation, and if you went back and looked at it again, what we wanted to really identify was that the value of certifications is different for different stakeholders, and although we're all friends, not everyone's got that balance of consequences and profit to make. So some examples. So vendors want to monetize security, that's the term we wanted to put in there, but we don't want to increase the cost of development. This is where you find arguments between different developers, where some want to include SDLC because they do it and they want to benefit from it, but then you have others who want to stick to the, they don't want certifications to be so long and invasive, so they'd rather not. End users want to maximize the value through investment in certified products, but don't necessarily want to pay for it. And the very final one, test equipment and specialist test software vendors only want to create an increased opportunity to sell their specialist equipment. So the final point, there's nothing wrong with test equipment vendors or test labs pointing out reasons as to why they want to do more business or want to sell their equipment. It's a free market, it's open speech, assurance and security vendors, they are businesses. But what we need to do is make sure that when we take the things that are presented at conferences like this, we make sure we take a balanced view on that when we read it back into the standards and fix the important things and don't allow the enthusiasm of some of the people that have more to gain to skew the things that we look at. So just as three simple things we thought to put up as common sense things that we can do to manage conflicts of interest. So decisions and transparency is something that's talked about a lot. Open proposals, recognizing that different people in the value chain have different views on where they get value from certifications. Open proposals should always be allowed, but I think they should only seriously be considered where there's a balanced group of stakeholders that are involved in deciding what changes are putting forward, what changes should go into standards. The final one, just to kind of take a different angle on it, standards groups need to be able to show that they're proactive in reaching out to Canvas for inputs. So we talk a lot about involving the end user, and this is something that's done. But what we also need to make sure we do is that where we have broad standards such as common criteria or FIPS, when we're considering inputs from the technical communities, that we consider all technology types. It's always very difficult with standards in that people who have most to gain are going to be most enthusiastic about attending standards meetings, but I think it's important to make sure that where there's a broad range of technologies covered by a certification standard, that where we make changes we think about all the different technology types and not just one class of technology. So the final thing we wanted to talk about, and linking back to the subject of the presentation, maintaining a standards balance sheet. So security certifications, like it or not, are a business. And either making, saving, or losing someone money. So typically with the health of a business is assessed based on a balance sheet. So why not try this for a standard? A balance sheet tracks where the value in the standard is coming from, for which stakeholders. It helps identify the cost of assurance and who it's being met by, which is an important thing. And ultimately, it allows an assessment of whether the net value of the standard is positive or negative. Ultimately, if there's no value in doing a certification standard, the certification standard with time will die. And so from the point of view of assessing the health of your certification standard, I think it's important to consider the value to the various stakeholders or communities that you bring, both as a combination of positive costs or profits, or profits minus costs, and how that works out. It's definitely an easier thing to do in a qualitative rather than a quantitative way, but even just looking at it qualitatively, it gives you an idea as to the angles the different people have in their involvement and what you need to do in order to try and maintain balance going forward and maximise the value of the standard. It's definitely an idea in its infancy, and it's one that can be expanded in the future. I'm sure we hear more people talking about it past this presentation. So, summary and conclusion. We talked about the value proposition of standards, and hopefully in the initial part of the presentation we got across that it's not simple. People's interactions with standards, doing motivations for doing presentations at events like this, are always complicated things, and I think it's important to recognise that. We've discussed a number of good developments and certifications alongside including some ideas that we're more than happy to discuss further following the presentation in more depth that we feel might help to address some of the problems identified. Not necessarily all the problems, and they're not necessarily the right answers, but I think they're worth things worth considering. Certification monetization is a phrase we put in this presentation, and we think it's one to keep hold of. If it loses its value in the business world, it will lose its relevance in an evolving world. And the final point is that for all the issues that we have and challenges we have as a community, we shouldn't be short of ideas when it comes to trying to keep our standards relevant ahead of creating new ones. That's it. Do we have any time for questions? Any questions?
I guess I think it makes absolute sense what you're saying about, I mean, hey, it's the usual, right? You can't measure it, you can't improve it, but if you don't get the feedback, if you don't gather information, you're not going to be able to bring improvement in a strategic sense to the whole certification, the various certification regimes are there. I get that. But I was also thinking at the same time, there's also a process of evolution of thinking, and you hint at it as well, that, you know, a lot of people can do a dumb thing over time, the bandwagoning notion. I'm thinking about, you know, what led to the financial downfall of 2008. I'm just wondering how you capture that, if you see what I'm trying to get at. There can be, I think, it is my impression, that there is a growing awareness, and I think you get at that in your presentation, of the value, although it's varied, you know, different players have a different notion of what certification brings to them. But that's something that can evolve over time, and it is through direct experience of it, simply just exposure to the ideas. Do you see what I'm getting at? I'm asking you it from a policymaker's point of view, and I know that's yucky of me.
Yeah, so I think it's sort of general high-level ideas and keeping them very high level. If you don't collect data on how markets are evolving or why people are doing standards in a continuous fashion, then you can't spot trends. So kind of moving from feedback to data mining, if you started to collect data on the quality, you know, feedback from vendors and how did they find the test labs, how did they find these changes, you can start to put together pictures, bigger pictures of things and how stuff's changing. But you do need to look over a longer period of time, but kind of going back to the quotes, you can only use the data you've got today to kind of guess at where things are going to go. I guess examples of where I see it's really important is that, so we have a lot of things around, you know, you have test labs pushing and saying, yay, 3-year certification lifecycle, more business for us. All good, but that probably means that they've got more work. And can they expand at a rate that they can accommodate that work in a way where the standards, the certifications can stay consistent and good, or does doing more certifications actually lead to a reduction in people's happiness and the outputs of certifications, and then that ultimately starts to diminish the value of doing the certifications as well. But it's also something you need to gather the data to start to look at trends. And I think the simple problem that we have at the moment is we don't gather any data. Whether it's a test lab or a scheme or even just vendors, there's not really, we comment on things that are changes, kind of after the changes have happened. And we quite often say, here's big ideas as to things that we want to do. But we don't have this longer trend, this line of data that allows us to kind of, as what you say, spot things that happens. And linking back to some of the one of the earlier presentations, which for anyone wasn't here, John Gita, I'd recommend listening to online. You know, there is data that, I think there was data that says that actually, fundamentally, we need to rethink through the value of certifications and how we do certifications. But if you're not collecting any data and getting feedback, then you're kind of a little bit stuck in groupthink land, where labs are saying, this is how we can improve the standards and schemes going, we need to bring down costs. But actually, are we doing completely the wrong thing to start with? And I think that, so the other thing I would add to that is that, kind of going back to the people who have something to gain from putting forward an idea are always going to be more motivated to do it. So you will see, for example, you know, just picking examples, people who have a network interface on a device and want to do online algorithm testing, it's a good thing for them. And it's something that they'll push and they'll spend a lot of time investing in and trying to convince people that it's something that's a step forward. If you're a token vendor or a smart card vendor, you don't have a network interface. And actually, algorithm validation testing, it's not that big a thing to us, being able to do it better. So you kind of see things get skewed a little bit. The other examples are changes when it comes into kind of the mention of different technology types. When we come to saying, oh, another protocol or another set of requirements that require processing time, it's probably okay for a next generation network encryptor or a firewall or a bit of software running on a server. But if you're a security token vendor, you know, you're absolutely hedged on what your performance is, how much battery you're consuming. If you need to start to do other things, then it can completely break your model as to whether you can do a certification or not. So it's very important to get balance across all the technology types to make sure that the changes you're making are actually helping, rather than essentially making the usefulness of the standard and the value go down. And I think that's kind of what the value proposition was all about in the balance sheet, is trying to understand that better.
Okay. Thank you. So now we have a networking break until a little after 11, so 11:10 is when the sessions begin. Thank you.